Well, I'd like to welcome you all to the afternoon program. The topic of this afternoon session is psychic growth. And it's my great pleasure to introduce our first speaker, who is Leslie Caldwell. Yes. Leslie Caldwell is a psychoanalyst in private practice in London, and she's honorary reader in the psychoanalysis unit at UCL. With Helen Taylor Robinson, she's joint general editor of the collected works of Donald Winnicott. Leslie.
Thank you very much, Jill. And thank you to the organizers for inviting me to... Can't hear me? Okay. Thank you to the organizers for inviting me to participate. And in a sense, I have to start with one thing, which is that I had intended to do a kind of slightly semi-autobiographical account of the half of my title topic that relates to being at home, because I was going to talk about how I got to feel at home in the outskirts of Rome. But when I looked at the amount of time I had to say anything at all remotely psychoanalytical, that bit had to go. So just how much there's going to be on being at home is a bit unclear. However, here we go. In 1951, in his first reading of his paper on transitional objects and transitional phenomena, Winnicott describes the baby who reaches out for an object beyond itself as signaling something important for the project of psychoanalysis. But at that stage, that is in the 1951 spoken presentation, it is not his major focus. Instead, that spoken text ascribes major attention to the substituted compensatory value of the transitional object. The transitional object, he says, is introduced when loneliness begins to be felt, when hunger threatens, when the baby is between waking and sleeping, states in which anxiety is common to all three. But even in that presentation, Winnicott went on to warn that it would not be wise to assume that its value indicates no more than its value as a mother substitute. So leaving quite a lot of space, really, which he then explored over the next 20 years, for where the notion of transitionality would go. The compensatory value of the transitional object continues to be acknowledged as important, but in a much more circumscribed way. So in 1971, Winnicott says, to some extent these objects stand for the breast, but it is not especially this point that is under discussion. Between 1951 and the 1953 publication of this paper, Winnicott slipped in a very neutral footnote referencing Fairbairn. We may really wonder why, since it looks extraordinarily dutiful. He says, the reader's attention is drawn to the use of the word transitional, in many places, by Fairbairn. Now, although Fairbairn's transitional stage does take us in a different direction, I think that this acknowledgement on Winnicott's part would warrant further consideration in a different kind of paper, and were there to be a bit more time. Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
That might be... I don't have a PowerPoint, so... so you aren't being deprived. A distraction. Okay. 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 How are we to understand what it means when a baby reaches for an actual, real object beyond itself? What is happening internally, and what might its developmental and symbolic implications be? To approach these questions is to look, temporarily speaking, both backwards into the immediate past. How does this happen? Why? And into the future. What does this movement outwards initiate of a life? And what is wrapped up in an initial desire for an engagement with a world beyond the baby's self? What the action itself embodies of the beginnings of a self as in Winnicott's terms, not as yet quite perceived as such by the infant, is still there in embryo in the 1951 account. The self that is in the process of being constituted precisely through that very activity of reaching out to encounter and simultaneously create an already existing world. A world lying there, ready, in the right conditions, for the Winnicottian baby, to create and encounter it. The baby has to encounter him or herself as a separate unit, and the condition of that possibility is the facilitating function of the mother, what Bion, borrowing a concept from Marion Milner, described as the mother's reverie. A deepening interest in the implications of just what the baby is doing and its significance for an account of human subjectivity gathers over the next two decades. So that the transitional object, we think of it as indicating the infant's imaginative inhabiting of an area described as between internal and external reality. This involves both separation and an acceptance of separateness. For Winnicott, both of these are linked to the beginnings of a perception of self and other. I am, you are. Later, he will go much further in suggesting how that separateness actually contributes to and creates the richness of the worlds we inhabit, the place where we live and can be at home. The introduction to Playing in Reality, the last volume, 1971, acknowledges this shift in emphasis, where Winnicott says, "It is generally recognized, I believe, that what I am referring to in this part of my work is not the cloth or the teddy bear the baby uses, not so much the object used as the use of an object. What the capacity to use an object means, what the reaching out towards an object heralds of human potential and growth, picks up on the complicated links between creativity and destructiveness that increasingly occupy Winnicott, especially in the last decade of his life. Attention to the object and its fate and its intrapsychic consequences opens up the matter of psychic aliveness and how the resources established in the early months of life contribute to the ongoing production of new psychic objects and to the condition of being able to be at home with oneself. These are central Winnicottian concerns, and they will carry a particular emphasis in the approach of the British independent tradition. And I'll tell you that in the most recent book, edited by John Keane, Cyra Derman, and Paul Williams on the independent tradition, I checked the index because the question of the object, which has come up in so many ways, I was thinking about. There are 67 entries for the word object attached to different ideas relating to the object. So in some kind of way, the whole question of thinking about objects and reaching towards objects is an area fraught with difficulty theoretically and conceptually. Winnicott seems to have lived to regret his 1953 review with Masoud Khan of Fairbairn's book Psychoanalytic Studies of the Personality, and he says as much in a talk to the 1952 Club in 1967. "I now became aware," says Winnicott, "that Fairbairn had made a tremendous contribution, even if we only take two things. One is object-seeking, which comes into the area of transitional phenomena, and so on. And the other is this thing of feeling real instead of feeling unreal. Our patients, more and more, turn out to be needing to feel real. And if they don't, then understanding is of extremely secondary importance." Winnicott became more and more concerned with his own version of the object in terms of this notion of object use, its relation to transitional space and to personal destructiveness. So perhaps instead of wanting to insist on or assert, for a variety of reasons which we won't have time to go into, his difference and put Fairbairn in his place, somewhat the tone of the 1953 review, an increased interest in what is signified in this reaching out for a material object and these first moves beyond the mother, while remaining linked with and connected with her and what she represents for the experience of being alive, could be seen as framing a common quest about the aims of psychoanalysis. Without, I think, negating the drives, it does significantly extend the psychoanalytic account of human subjectivity and the direction of the analytic treatment. The art historian Tim Clark's book, The Site of Death, is a rumination on art and its place through Tim Clark's own involvement with two paintings by Poussin, Landscape with a Man Killed by a Snake and Landscape with a Calm. Clark went every day for a year or so to look at these related paintings hanging in the Los Angeles Art Institute, and the book that resulted tackles why he and we find ourselves returning to certain pictures time and time again. Clark wonders what it is we're looking for and whether and how our understanding of an image changes over time. In his review, the Independent's art critic of the time, now dead, Tom Lubbock, said that the book takes inexhaustibility seriously. For me, this echoes the work of the consulting room for both its protagonists. Psychoanalysis, too, is about inexhaustibility. What enables someone to sit every day for a year in front of two paintings, for me, resonates with what keeps a patient coming to analysis four or five times a week, year after year, and indeed what enables their analyst or therapist to sit there with them. It opens up the same sorts of questions about what it is that makes life worthwhile, and relatedly, what and how the work of the consulting room contributes to this. From the 50s, Winnicott increasingly explored an interest in something ongoing that enables a fundamental continuity between life and more life, between living and being alive, and the kinds of experience that might disrupt or impede that capacity. Inexhaustibility can summarize our relations with others and with ourselves only so long as we have the will, the desire to communicate, to live, to be. At some periods in life, assuredly, we have considerably less will and desire for this capacity. But in its general concern with health, the direction of playing in reality focuses both on psychoanalysis and the demanding work of the consulting room to question its perhaps taken for granted priorities, and I think to try to move beyond it, psychoanalytically speaking, to cast a perspective and a lens beyond the consulting room while concentrating on what happens in it, in order to facilitate the conditions in which living outside it and living with oneself and others and perhaps feeling real can be elaborated further and for some people even perhaps activated. The capacity to play, as we know, very associated with Winnicott, is a distinctive aspect of being human, but he traces its potential in the earliest contacts between infant and mother. And in the engagement with how healthy living is arrived at and maintained, and what it depends on, he returns us to the roots of the self, to how we use the capacities we have, and how we can increase them as resources in our lives and our work. In emphasizing this capacity and signaling the huge deprivation of its absence, I would say that Winnicott remains the clinician's clinician. He provides a confirmation of the place where we, in this instance, we clinicians, live. It is very difficult to be at home with others without the capacity to be at home with oneself. And in the famous paper from which this derives, Winnicott studies the words, I am alone, in turn. The word I, he suggests, implies a much emotional growth. But it is simply a topographical statement of the personality as a thing, as an organization of nuclei. No reference is being made to living. Next, in the words I am, a stage in individual growth, where the individual not only has shape, but has life. The individual may be undefended, is undefended, vulnerable, potentially paranoid, raw. Can only achieve this stage, however, because there exists a protective environment, the mother, preoccupied with her own infant. But what Winnicott adds here is that at this stage of I am, there is no need to postulate an awareness on the part of the infant that that mother actually exists as a separate person. Next, we come to the words, the whole phrase, I am alone. According to his theory, therefore, he says, I am putting forward this further stage, which does involve an appreciation on the part of the infant of the mother's continued existence. By this, says Winnicott, I do not necessarily mean an awareness with the conscious mind. I consider, however, that I am alone is a development from I am, dependent on the infant's awareness of the continued existence of a reliable mother whose reliability makes it possible for the infant to be alone and to enjoy being alone for a limited period. Now, 4 minutes. Okay. The sense of location and groundedness and its contribution to aliveness and to being at home with oneself invites thought about how we retain, or indeed develop, the inner security to be gained in occupying what Winnicott comes to call in the 60s potential space. And Jonathan referred to it earlier on today. What, for instance, he says, are we doing, familiar in quotation, when we're listening to a Beethoven symphony, making a pilgrimage to a picture gallery, reading Troilus and Cressida in bed, or playing tennis? It is not only what we are doing, the question also needs to be posed, where are we, if anywhere at all? Where are we when we are doing what in fact we do a great deal of the time, namely, and this might be contentious in the light of fun earlier, enjoying ourselves? On the other side, clinical work raises the disastrous situation for the real lived life of people, our patients, and indeed sometimes ourselves, if we do not have those places exposing the quiet torture of those people who cannot bear to be alone. The foundations of these capacities and how they come to be there, how they can be encouraged and enlarged to a greater or lesser extent to be drawn on throughout our lives are the tasks both of analysis and of ordinary living. Winnicott certainly emphasizes the conditions without which a person is unlikely to be able to find a place within the self to just be, a place from which to draw the strength to get on and live the life there is, with all its difficulties, its rewards, its bereavements, and so on. In another paper, Creativity and Its Origins, he describes people who are so firmly anchored in objectively perceived reality that they are ill in the direction of being out of touch with the subjective world and with the creative approach to fact. This seems to me as good a description as any of the contemporary public world in general and of health provision, in this country at least, in particular. And one description of our work as clinicians might be a creative approach to fact, an interest in human potential, an ability to engage either with its inexhaustibility or to maintain a belief in its existence, even when our patients seem so far from it. How can that potential, once laid down, if laid down, but still only there in potential, be drawn upon and expanded through the work of psychoanalysis? And what of the development of a potential that didn't get a look in at the start? Can what might never have been there be fostered by the analytic relation? Theoretically and clinically, the capacity to withstand the effect of division and conflict has been increasingly located in early processes and their dependence upon an already constituted psychosocial grouping with whom the infant negotiates. It is this capacity for negotiation and for finding places first in the infant and then latterly, ongoingly in ourselves, from which we can negotiate the shape of the conflicts and difficulties that shape the current world and our relation to it. Being at home with oneself and psychic aliveness seem to me to depend on each other and are linked. Being real is a part of psychic aliveness, and it and being at home with oneself involve the capacity also to be alone with oneself and the related capacity to inhabit a potential space. If those capacities are in place, we have the internal psychological tools to maintain our own aliveness and generally, not always, to manage the inevitable disappointments and devastating losses that are the stuff of human existence.
Thank you very much, Leslie. We're now allowed to inhabit the potential space. Any questions or comments to Leslie's presentation? I'm coming to meet you.
Thank you, Leslie. Seamus Pryor from the University of Edinburgh. Could you say a little bit more about the connection you made between what Winnicott said about the ill person who is too wedded to external reality and objectivity and the current British National Health Service?
I only have 5 minutes. I actually think that it would probably be a question better answered by someone fighting it out in the health service, which I am very pleased to say that I'm not. But I do have patients who are fighting it out in the health service, and they have my entire sympathy. But what I was, the connection I was trying to make was that the notion of being wedded to an objective reality leaves out any possibility of thinking much more creatively about what the kinds of psychological problems that arrive in the National Health Service, both for children, and I've been particularly recently thinking about the cuts in services to children, but I'm sure Anne can say much more about that than I can, and the sorts of resources that seem possible to provide for people in need. And this morning, actually, on Radio 4, I heard a fascinating program, I don't know whether anyone else heard it, about something set up by a clinical psychologist in Somerset or Wales or somewhere, called Walk and Talk. And this group meet once a week and walk and talk. People whose services were cut, for whom medication didn't work and so on. I'd consider that one of them. I don't know that that's an answer, but...
Any other comments?
Thank you. You helped me understand something. There's been far too much, and I wouldn't have wanted anything less here in what you've said. And my sense is you're a transitional object to our conference, which is an object. All of the speakers, in a way. And in my own thought, life is not a race. There was an Irish farmer who met a Spanish farmer and said, "Oh, you say mañana, mañana. What do you have in Ireland for that?" They say, "We don't have anything that urgent." I make a suggestion for tomorrow that perhaps the strict boundaried theoretically correct parent, I'm not just talking to you, but all of us, does not get the, give the democracy and the child, meaning us as a community, a sense of high self-esteem. And I wonder if we could, because there's so much more you and us could, I wonder if we could tomorrow be a little less perfect so that we have an object, that is, a little less satisfying. We already have that air, technology, da da da. But
speaking of boundaries, I'm afraid okay. I'll have to remove your speaking equipment.
The thing is, what you know, really... What you really want to do is destroy the object as well you might, because actually that's the creative process that Winnicott takes us in the direction of. Knock us all around a bit.
Right. Look, there are many ways to run such a conference. This one has this particular method of trying to share the time among many people who have many things to say. Leslie, you have given us a wonderful presentation to start us off. Thank you. And now we'll hear from...
Sorry.
It's right there on the...
I'll go to the back after.
It's on... And it's right there. You know how to work it, yeah?
1, 2, 1, 2. The test one.
Are you also sure how to advance the slides? While Anne is getting fixed up with her microphone, let me introduce you to Anne Alvarez, who is a consultant child and adolescent psychotherapist in London, the author of Live Company, Psychotherapy with Autistic, Borderline, Deprived and Abused Children, and another book called The Thinking Heart, 3 Levels of Psychoanalytic Therapy with Disturbed Children. Anne.
Okay, thank you very much. Well, it seems to be a lovely, fascinating conference, and I'm sorry I can't do and be here for all of it. But I also probably need to apologize for this paper, because I think that what it is a Kleinian talking to herself. And it may be of no interest to the rest of you. It's rather pedantic. It's just something I needed to do for me. And I hope it's of some interest, and if it isn't, I really apologize. Well, you've got the title up there. It's well known that Melanie Klein made a vital distinction between the anxieties, defense mechanisms, and processes characteristic of the depressive position and those of characteristic of the paranoid schizoid position. Her original distinction in 1935 was between the depressive position and the paranoid position, but in 1946, impressed by the contributions of Fairbairn and Winnicott on the nature of unintegrated states, she amplified the term paranoid to become the paranoid schizoid position. She saw that schizoid withdrawal from feeling with states of fragmentation and unintegration were characteristic of these more disturbed states of mind in adults, but also in slightly different ways in very young babies. This is my schematic representation of the depressive position, and it's... I know these things are difficult because other people's internal pictures of such things are always different from everybody else's, but that's how I think of it, as these sort of two thermometers with the love, good objects, by the way, folks, ideal and idealization objects, idealized objects, which I think need to be distinguished from ideal and from good, safety, hope, trust, self-worth. You can see them all, I hope. And the whole question of whether any of these are being used protectively or defensively against the other side of the personality, which is, I can't see it from here, but I imagine it's hate and bad objects, persecutory anxieties, fear, suspicion, shame gets left out by the Kleinians, and it's terribly important. Impotence, which is the other side of omnipotence, and there isn't room in there for potency, but we need to have potency over there. Despair, which I think is ununderstood and understudied in our field, and the whole question of whether some of these aggressive things are destructive or protective. But the point that Klein made was, and Hannah Siegel after her and Meltzer all emphasized, that the loving side of the personality had to be stronger than the hating before you could get to the depressive position. And it's my view that we sometimes forget this and try to induce premature integrations long before the patients are ready to integrate. Now, I've gone too far. That's one view of the paranoid position. Actually, there are two views of it. I haven't put them both there because sometimes Klein described it as though the two sides were highly developed, love and hate, but strongly split, as in normal infancy. But a lot of times what people are really describing is patients where the persecutory side is hugely developed, and in my experience, the trust and sense of safety or secure base or whatever language you want to use or belief in a good object is extremely reduced. And the question is, what do we do about this psychoanalytically? And what I'm introducing today is another problem, which is the question of empty and or dissociated states where neither side of the affective part of the personality is developed. And this is not always because both are being repressed or defended against. Sometimes it's because they're really not developed in some of these very empty children. And that's what I'll be talking about mostly, and why I think we might try and separate out. Anyway, I'll go on about the theory. That's where the sense of goodness and badness are both weak. This is extremely oversimplified because I'm including in this kind of patient a particular subgroup of autistic children. I'm including the neglected, deprived children who've really missed out on real reciprocity. I'm also including states of chronic dissociation. This is very tricky. I spent years trying to figure out what's the difference between these empty states and dissociation. Well, dissociation cuts contacts that have already been made, links that have already been made in the brain. But these unassociated, unintegrated children I'm thinking of have hardly made the connections. And I'm relieved that now some research has been done on the effect of neglect on the brain, and it's really profound. It's much worse than abuse. Alan Shore always said it's much worse than abuse in its effect. And so I'm saying, which isn't a very Kleinian thing to say, and you may think not a very psychoanalytic thing to say, that not all unintegrated states are necessarily the result of a defensive disintegration. I'm saying sometimes the links have never been made. The concept of deficit, as you well know, in America, and Bick's concept of unintegration, helpless unintegration over here, have caused huge controversies. They have theirs over there, and we have ours over here. And they seem that the idea of unintegration seems to attack Freud's great insight into the dynamic nature of thought processes. They're inherent. When I started working with these children, I thought, but it has to be meaningful. It has to be defensive. It has to be explainable. Why aren't my interpretations working? Because what Freud taught us all to see is that these interactions between thoughts were inherently meaningful and inherently purposive. That is a dynamic system. And this is a very old issue, actually. Fairbairn pointed out that although Freud's concept of repression was the foundation stone upon which the whole explanatory system represented by psychoanalytic theory had been built, this had nevertheless not been an unmixed gain, because it left no room for the idea of ego weakness. And he pointed out, which Charcot had ascribed to the hysterics that he and later Freud were treating. In child work, we might add the dynamic model, which implies that every state of mind, however pathological, arises from meaningful motivation, which is what I was trained to believe and believed passionately. Nevertheless, that concept leaves no room for ego immaturity, and therefore for the idea of something like helplessness, which is not the same as masochism or masochistic passivity. I am suggesting that certain pathological affectless states do differ from even the most persecuted of states of mind. So that's why I've divided the paranoid states from the schizoid ones, where there's deficit or chronic dissociation. And by the way, in adult psychiatry, where I used to work as a young psychologist, they very much distinguish between the organized paranoid and the paranoid schizophrenic who's decompensating. I mean, I was raised on that. I imagine that diagnostic distinction is still out there. But to stay for a while, I just want to backtrack for a minute to some thoughts I've had over the years about the usual Kleinian term, the paranoid schizoid position, before I suddenly thought that the two should be separated. I have been suggesting for some years that we need much more study of the tiny steps, in recovery with patients who are like our traumatized and abused and somewhat neglected children, and the whole question of how we build up that left side of the personality. And when you get a bit more trust, child begins to believe that you're going to come back on Monday and not die or not kill them, begins to believe you might like them, begins to believe that maybe liking people is nice. They begin to like liking. That can be very new for some of the psychopathic children or the very embittered children. And they may even start having feelings of love. So as a general concept, I took the Kleinian term over this for you people. You don't need this from me, but I need it. about whether increases in the left side were increases in defensive life instinct, as it were, or whether we could see increases in that side as an overcoming of fear and persecution and mistrust. And there's a wonderful Kleinian concept of overcoming, and she made this point that reparation was not a defense against guilt. It was an overcoming of guilt. And I think we need the same sort of concept, or we Kleinians do, you may not, for the build-up in the left side and how you help a child to overcome fear and mistrust and bad objects by building up, I think, good objects inside, is different from just helping somebody to increase their defenses against it. Now, where am I? Okay. Okay. And then I started making a little list of terms that would stand opposite the more persecutory ones and would stand opposite the defensive ones. So potency is different from omnipotence. A sense of agency and pride is different from defensive narcissism. It involves self-respect and pride. Relief, joy, and hope are different from manic denial. And we need to notice the difference. Order, structure, and predictability. She always comes back on Monday. And for that matter, a sense of safety is very different from an obsessional denying defense. There's a term that I love that I borrowed from Kundera, one of his novels, that I thought would match the Kleinian term reparation for the depressive position, and it's a term he uses when people demand justice and revenge for torture or abuse, and he called it rectification, and I think it's a lovely word for the paranoid schizoid position. And I think we all know that if you, nowadays, thanks to the self-psychologists and to many other things, Bion's concept of containment over time and stuff, that you can escalate anxiety by overinterpreting it if there's not enough ego and hope on the left-hand side. Because I didn't put ego there, but we need to. Anyway, I'm interested in, I know that John Steiner has written about psychic retreats, but I think I would want to add to his concept a concept of a psychic desert, because a psychic retreat is a place to go. In a psychic desert, there's nowhere to go. And that arose for me as a distinction with working with patients who turned out not to be hiding, but to be lost. And I think that's a really important distinction. Okay. Now, but in this paper, I'm interested in a more general issue than any of those specific lists I just made, a quite fundamental development. That is, when you get these affectless schizoid or autistic states, how do they move to these more alive states? And sometimes it doesn't matter whether the affect they finally feel is positive or negative. Often the first one that comes is negative, by the way. But it isn't always, and the point is that there's affect there, finally. And that, but even when it is a persecutory object, it can be a development, because finally there's somewhere that isn't occupied by badness. If the bad hallucination is over there, this bit of the room is safe. Anyway, I wanted to say something about psychopathic children, but I'll have to leave that. I want to come back to the deprived and neglected one. I think we do see in these affectless states people who've really gone beyond states of despair to states of giving up, which really is different from dissociation. I really believe that's different from dissociation. But chronic dissociation can lead to something very similar. That's the problem. But with these children who've given up having any agency or hope of making an impact on an object, a more severe possible outcome is the blunting of mind and feeling and the stunting of brain growth with its attendant emotional and cognitive delay. And so many of the learning, I see Valerie's here, she knows this, so many of the learning disabled children and adults that people see are some of the most damaged people in the country, and they're not, it's not because they have Down syndrome or prenatal brain damage. They are so neglected, and were so neglected 40 or 50 years ago, even more, that their brains are damaged by neglect, and yet they get this diagnosis of learning disability, and the little children get the diagnosis of developmental delay. And finally, some research has shown the effect of emotional neglect on the baby's brain. That's Bruce Perry, who did the first research on the effect of trauma. Oh, my God. Okay. Okay, well, anyway, it damages the brain. I better just leave that. And stuff doesn't grow in the brain. Synapses don't get made. I'll stop all that and give you one clinical vignette. Okay. I would like to have talked about the brain research, too, but there's no time. About the seeking system, panksep, about interesting objects, not loved or hated, interesting objects. This is something connecting the technical ideas. An autistic patient of mine, Robbie, told me one day, at a period when he was becoming more reachable, that long ago his uncle had helped him out of a deep freeze, where he'd been stuck and left to be dead forever and ever, with no eyes, no ears, no mouth, and no penis. And then he demonstrated what it was like coming out of the deep freeze, with his legs moving terribly slowly. And I thought it was a very vivid image of what it's like to come out of those states, and how long it takes, and how much practice it takes for people like that to stay out of them. Many years later, when he was in his 20s, he was much more independent, less engaged in his ritualistic talk, and altogether saner. His conversation, he didn't go into these old autistic rituals anymore, but it was extremely dull and boring, and he'd tell you, I helped Mum sweep the leaves yesterday. And I suddenly became aware one day that when I opened the door to him, even though I was glad he was sane, my eyes were probably dull. Whereas when I went down the hall at the Tavistock to see another little autistic child who was much crazier and more vicious, but was full of this compressed vitality, there was always a spring in my step because it was a challenge and he was so alive in his horrible way. And I started worrying about what I could do about this. Someone said, there's nothing you can do, it's the autonomic nervous system. And I thought, well, we look at our countertransferences. And this particular day, he came in and suddenly pointed to the brass doorknob on the way down the hall and said, I want to be that doorknob. And I thought, oh, my God, it's his old autistic ritual. He used to want to be a weather vane. And I thought, oh, my God. And then I thought, but he didn't sound autistic. So when we got downstairs, I said, why do you want to be the doorknob? And he said, because it's so shiny. And I found myself thinking of Alan Shore's work on the fact that when you say somebody's eyes lit up, it's a fact. It's because the pupils dilate and more light gets in on the retina. And all Trevarthen's work on the importance of babies being able to delight their parents, delight, bring them to life and to light. And so what I said to him was, I know what I should have said when you came in the door, Rob, because he was only coming once a month. I should have said, how lovely to see you. I haven't seen you for a whole month. And he said, as I said it, the color came into his cheeks and his eyes lit up. And I felt very moved. I felt like weeping. I still do every time I think of it. But anyway, I changed my technique with him and became much more alert to whether I was really looking right into his eyes and staying alive with him. Not that I hadn't been working on the issue for like 40 years by then with him, but as a sort of momentary thing. And it really helped the dullness and helped him to stay alive in a non-perverse way, because he was very good at giving himself kicks by doing this perverse talking. Anyway, I suppose I have to stop. Oh, I have a minute. Good. Brilliant. Well, I will recommend to you Pangsep's work on the seeking system, because I've become much more interested with these particularly empty patients in whether the object's interesting and pulls the child forward, which is quite different from whether they feel love or hate. Just whether it's interesting is so crucial with these kids. And I also think it's interesting with Beyond's K, because he added the desire to get to know the object, and he said that was different from love and hate. And he thought it was quite neglected too. Okay. Yeah.
Well, thank you very much, Anne, for a very lively and curiosity-seeking look at schizoid states. Anne will take comments for the next 5 minutes. This is our moment for democracy. I mean, use it. Yeah, here we go.
Jill Salberg from NYU postdoctoral program. Thank you. It was a wonderful paper. You really started to bring to life towards the end, as you were building on your ideas, what back in New York we are very much involved in relational, two-person, intersubjective work. And by the end with Robbie, I was thinking that Robbie actually was supervising you. That he was giving you a tip.
What a good idea.
And that it's very much a two-person co-created moment. And I was wondering how you might see it that way and think about
it. Well, it's a lovely thought. I hadn't thought of it, but he certainly was telling me what he needed, wasn't he?
Yes.
And it's interesting that I was starting to get very worried about how bored I was feeling and that I should be so glad that he was sane finally and not doing this other stuff. And yet it was so placating and dull, really.
And he sensed it in you.
He must have, yes. I mean, you know, the way many autistic children, you know, only peripherally monitor your gaze. They know the minute you've looked away, and sometimes it's quite a good thing to look away if they're rather perversely frustrating you. You know, you can play a bit of cat and mouse together, but which is good for them, if you see what I mean, as long as you're open about it. Yeah, well, why should I look at you if you won't talk to me? You know, that kind of thing can be very useful. But I wasn't there with that. He had such sweetness, too, and I think it disarmed my honesty, almost, with myself.
Any other comments?
David Scharf, and I think this is in the territory, but I don't mean that he said it all, of Fairbairn schizoid personality, where the retreat to the inner world isn't explained by the degree of deprivation, which we now understand, but that the affect of that inner world is futility. It's really the hopelessness,
yeah,
which is often mistaken for depression, but it isn't.
No, it's much worse.
And I just think it's the territory that he began to open up, which, of course, like many other things, has filled in much richer ways since then.
No, but I like the word futility, because I know it went beyond despair, but I wasn't finding a word for it. I think that's a really helpful word. Yeah.
Any other comments?
Thank you. Hello, Anne. I enjoy your presentation very much. It's just one sort of quick word, really. And it's this question which Joe Schwartz talked about, whether there's a good object or not. And I still think there is a good object. But I do think that they are the bad object and the good object do seem to be internalized in a different place. I think Joe tried to get hold of that when he said that the good object is taken in a diffuse way and becomes part of the self, whilst I think the bad object has a tendency to remain feeling that it's not part of the self and is like an alien object which has to be got rid of. And I think it's it's that sort of bad alien object which is part of your paranoid schizoid state. And you said, you didn't say, but there was a question of do enough good objects balance the scales against the bad objects?
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me they never do. And this is one of the things that frustrates parents or foster parents who take on these children, and they do their darndest, and they provide everything for the child. And they get so frustrated because it never seems to balance it. And somewhere the bad object and the bad relationship seems to stick in the mind in a way that the good objects don't seem to. The good objects seem to disappear and go. Sorry.
Well, I mean, the good object, yes. But if the child is in treatment or occasionally with hugely sensitive foster parents, good new objects can be built up. I think we see this happening all the time in child psychotherapy. They may be much weaker than the bad, and if you can, you're lucky enough to get the child for years and years, you can really see children beginning to think, she really does come back. She comes back after holidays. She doesn't beat me when I do something naughty or, I think you can really see real, real changes in the, I had a big argument with Joe about it at the break, but about, it's hardly how you define an object. He said it's all memory of good experiences. Well, memory of bad experiences with a little fantasy thrown in on each side. I don't see the difference. I think good objects do get built up in treatment.
Well, on that hopeful note, we say thank you to Anne.
I don't know where it is, even. Very much.
Oops. Thank you.
No,
no PowerPoint. Is that right?
Our next speaker is Graham Clark. Graham Clark is a visiting fellow at the Center for Psychoanalytic Studies at the University of Essex. He's the author of Personal Relations Theory, Fairbairn, McMurray, and Sutty, and co-editor of the book that we're about to celebrate called Fairbairn and the Object Relations Tradition.
Hello. At this point in time, I think it might be sensible for me to say something that I used to say between the various sketches in Monty Python, which is, and now for something completely different. Because I'm going to use this opportunity to remind us all of John Pardle's interpretation of Fairbairn's psychology of dynamic structure using the model of endopsychic structure that Fairbairn developed. I believe that this model of inner reality is still vital, and I look forward to more detailed developments of this approach. Pardle gives a convincing account of psychic growth, and when considered in combination with Fairbairn's theory of aesthetic experience, this account can also be seen as describing the creative process. We are here in the territory of the mind as a multi-agent system, as Sutherland in his 63 paper on the conceptual model of psychoanalysis argued. The bare bones of this system are three dyadic relationships. A central ego in relation to an ideal object directly repressing the following structures. An anti-libidinal ego related to an anti-libidinal or rejecting object. A libidinal ego related to a libidinal or exciting object. Repression of the libidinal ego and its exciting object is further reinforced by the anti-libidinal dyad's attack upon it. As Southern writes, these structures are conceived as dynamic psychological systems constantly in active relationship with each other and with the outside world. Each structure has a greater complexity and depth into which is built its history. The particular experiences of the person will contribute many subsystems which could, for instance, be precipitates of repressed relations at the oral, anal, or phallic phases of classical theory. But there is a tendency for these constituent subsystems to group or assume a hierarchical order around the image of one person, even if only loosely. The first manifestation of a bad object relationship in the course of analysis may therefore center around one or other of these subsystems, but as the analysis proceeds, all of the components come to the surface. This systemic understanding of Fairbairn's theory is crucial in my view, but not as widely pursued as it should be. However, John Pardle, in a number of papers, has looked at psychic growth from within this perspective. And in our book, we have included an early paper by Pardle on Fairbairn's theory, which I can thoroughly recommend to you all. One of Pardle's clearest expositions of psychic growth in Fairbairn's theory was published in the journal Free Associations. And it is this interpretation that I think shows best how the psychology of dynamic structure and the idea of psychic growth and creativity are interconnected. Pardle answers the question, what is the aim of psychoanalytic treatment, from one of Fairbairn's own cases? Quote, breaching the closed system of the patient's world, reducing the tripartite splitting of the ego, and promoting a maximum synthesis of the parts into which it has been split are the key points. But Pardell asks, what really happens? For Pardell, this is related to another question. What is the structure of the central ego and how has it grown? Pardell wants to see, and to help us see, this multi-agent system in action as it develops and changes. Pardell conceptualizes the central ego and its ideal object as an emotionally rich and complex store of available relationships and relational possibilities, given an imaginative use of splitting and recombining. He suggests that it's not splitting itself that is the problem, but the keeping apart of ideas and feelings that need to be brought into relation with each other. He argues that the subsidiary libidinal and anti-libidinal relationships cannot be lacking in complexity given the ways in which we come to know them in so many different guises in dreams, nor can they be absolutely split off from the central ego. Using a musical analogy, he says that repression in Fairbairn's diagram can be represented by the leader of a string trio, hardly listening to the other two players, but their being still present and audible if only he would attend to them. Pardell says that analytic therapy works by making more exchanges available between the central ego and its subsidiaries, which allows the whole personality more possibilities of exchange with other people in the outside world. I think that if we adopt the language of agents and powers, then we can see that repression is the restriction of the person's full powers by their being split off into one or other of the subsidiary structures and repressed. Psychic growth, then, is the repatriation of those powers to the central self. Pardell describes what might be called everyday learning from experience and the development of new powers as the central ego grows by internalizing fresh relationships from the outside world. This approach is not very different from others like Mitchell and Rubens, who think that this is the principal mechanism of psychic growth. However, Pardell argues that these new experiences are liable to be shorn of their unacceptable and novel aspects, which he suggests get sorted and filed into the categories libidinal and anti-libidinal. And he cites Stanley Palumbo, who argues that we do this sorting and filing largely unconsciously in sleep. Pardell describes this process as one where the already repressed attracts relational experiences that have links with it. However, he also argues that this can lead to these repressed relational structures becoming perturbed by this new experience, worked over and possibly released from repression if suitable links are found with preconscious memories and with this fresh material. In this way, new experiences can change one's attitude to the external world and make one resort one's internal files. To address the differences that he sees between his view and that of Mitchell and Rubens, Pardell offers the following account of the importance of transference. I'm quoting two long quotes from Pardell. The growth of the central ego must take place by working over and accepting elements from the repressed structures. This requires interpretive links between the two-person and three-person system. The only way in which the two-person system can be activated in such a manner that new experience does not become internalized, sorted, and filed in the old, closed system of relationships is by the other person making some interpretive links in the in a two-person relationship. And this is the crucial importance of transference in interpretations. He develops this approach in some detail. I believe, quoting again, that the links are normally made like this. First, the therapist shows understanding of the three-person situation presented by the patient, with some recognition of the problems it presents for him. To that extent, the therapist is accepting what is brought, but also differentiating the libidinal and anti-libidinal elements in it. which have made the patient reject the whole libidinal-anti-libidinal relationship. Next, the therapist's strategy depends upon his assessment of the sympathetic relationship. The repressed relationships in it, libidinal and anti-libidinal, cannot be equally bad or equally repressed at the same time. The libidinal is bad when it threatens basic stability, which the anti-libidinal ensures, and the anti-libidinal is bad when it prevents or inhibits the basic enjoyment which gives meaning to living. So each of these rejected relationships will need to be looked at from the point of view of the other. The therapist showing that the patient is putting him in the role now of seducer or disturber, now of the disapprover or inhibitor. Finally, the previously rejected libidinal-anti-libidinal relationship may be reviewed for its reality-based badness or desirableness. Pardell argues that he is not putting forward a prescriptive account, but suggesting that when we feel we have been effective in a therapeutic episode, these are likely to be the important aspects of it that we can distinguish. He also believes that when the therapy is stuck, this account may help suggest some factors that may have been lurking undetected. I believe that this process, where the powers of the central self are enhanced by the addition of transformed powers that had been previously dissociated and repressed into the subsidiary selves during early development, is a crucial part of what we call psychic growth. Psychic growth therefore comes from the transformation and the retranscription of object relational possibilities previously denied the person through dissociation and repression. This process is also at the heart of creativity as understood by Fairbairn. It answers the question of where the new comes from by pointing to the transformations of object relational possibilities previously closed to the central self during the process of making an object for oneself and one's fellows, which is the core of the creative act in Fairbairn's theory of art. In a review of John Rickman's work, Fairbairn suggests the way in which an object relations approach to the creative process might work is by taking elements from the primitive subsidiary selves, transforming them, and making them acceptable to the central self. This process, which he says could work in a way that was also acceptable to others, is nevertheless variable, and his development of the notions of over and under symbolization was an approach to different styles within history that found favour with Herbert Reed in his attempt to understand value in art. There is much still to explore and develop here, as Stephen Levine's paper this morning illustrates. In a recent paper on art and emotions in the International Journal of Applied Psychoanalytic Studies, Pinchas Noy and Dorit Noy Sharav give their account of musical creativity, and this seems to me to echo Fairbairn's view of the process as one of growth as well as creativity. And I quote, "The creative solution is the dynamic opposite of the neurotic solution. While neurosis is a regressive solution that attempts to restore inner equilibrium at the cost of preventing the free expression of dangerous wishes by repression, splitting, etc., creativity is a progressive solution. It represents the artist's effort of expressing destructive or forbidden impulses while at the same time mastering them. While neurosis tends to redundancy and repetition, resisting change, creativity is an attempt to generate new and daring patterns of adaptation which have never been tried out before. This does not mean that a creative artist may not be neurotic, borderline, or even psychotic. He may even harbour a dynamic fluctuation between the neurotic and creative states. However, the creative solution, contrary to the neurotic or psychotic one, is a step in the direction of mental health. When the artist, after overcoming his own resistance, creates a new form through which he expresses his conflicting emotions, that package typically includes the required means to overcome the resistances and defences of the art consumer. These assist him or her in organising the inner chaos produced, in reducing any anxiety aroused, and in attaining the supreme goal of any creative artist, to convert excitement, distress and anxiety into pleasure, enchantment, or elation. Fairbairn's conception of the over or under symbolized work of art would allow this process to become one in which an audience with a similar endopsychic structure and cultural experience would be able to appreciate and acknowledge the work, while others would be unable or less able to acknowledge its worth. To recap, the basic endopsychic structure is three dyadic, relations-based, internal working models of mother and self, based upon the splitting of early relationships with mother into the acceptable, the over-exciting, and the over-rejecting. In the process of psychic growth, relationship possibilities that have been repressed become possible again and are reintegrated into the central ego ideal object dyad. Thus, psychic growth within Fairbairn's theory represents the reconstitution of the mother and the reintegration of the self in a dialectical movement that rehearses the Kleinian idea of reparation towards mother and the Winnicottian idea of development of the self. This is also the best description of the creative process from an object relations perspective I know of. Thank you.
Thank you, Graham. Now we have time for audience participation with Graham. Yes, Eleanor.
I was wondering if I could ask something. I was listening to you. I was thinking of Winnicott in the difference between creativity and creative living. And if I remember Fairbairn, it's something he talked about, the artist can show things, but he's not necessarily expressing it in the interaction with the other. If you remember, it's not in a relationship. You know, I thought mature dependence is interacting with a differentiated other.
Right.
I just wondered, you know,
well,
about creativity and creative living.
Certainly that the process of psychic growth that I've just described, mm-hmm. as I understand it, is aimed towards mature dependence, or at least if it moves in the direction of recuperating previously repressed and dissociated possibilities for the person, then it's moving in the direction of mature dependence. Of course, the way the world is cannot make it move in the opposite direction. So sort of the opposite to that, which would be psychic contraction, could also happen. So there's no guarantee that this process will work. But if we are moving towards mature dependence, then I would argue that these are the sorts of processes that are going to be involved in so doing.
And other comments? Anne.
Well, I only wanted to underline what you just said that moment, really. It's just underlining it, which is that sometimes the bravery it takes to make this creation is costly, and they pay a price from their superego or whatever.
Okay, coming back. Any other questions or comments for Graham? Yep, Stephen?
Thank you, Graham, for that very challenging and interesting paper. One comment that I meant to make this morning in quoting from Gustav Vigeland, the Norwegian sculptor, when asked about the creative act and its joys, he scoffed at the interviewer, insisting creativity is agony. That's what it is. And in my previous work on Monet and repetition, that's my sense of reading the 3,000 letters that Monet left behind and the letters of all the artists that I've struggled to get to know over these years, Degas and Manet and Picasso and Matisse. I don't know an artist who ever claims to be satisfied.
Do you want to respond to that, Graham, or would you like to take another comment?
I'm just thinking about how I was going to respond to that. I mean, what I've been saying is that trying to liberate from the repressed, dissociated, unconscious, the powers that you have hived off maybe decades ago, and begin to open yourself up to relationships which can include some of those things, expand your possibilities in order to express an artistic or make an artistic product in some way or another. It seems to me that that is going to be necessarily painful, in the same way that it will be painful within therapy to begin to address some of your shortcomings as they become obvious to you in relation to your therapist, for instance.
Well, Graham, would you think that therapy is a work of art?
Well, I think that Fairbairn thought that lots of things were works of art. I think he thought that gardening, cooking, a whole load of things that we don't normally think of as art are art, because they can involve us in all sorts of ways. And so I wouldn't rule out therapy as art. If it isn't creative, then it probably isn't therapy.
Yeah, exactly.
So Graham, so I was thinking about this. So what did you feel when you completed this book we've done?
Seriously, I don't think I've actually reached that moment yet. I feel as if we have completed that yet.
There you are. You have to wait for tonight, or no,
tomorrow night.
Yeah, you said the artist was never satisfied.
Exactly.
Well, I mean, because it seems to me generally, I don't feel a sense of joy and, oh my God, this is the greatest thing since sliced bread or something like that. That if it's gone pretty well, I feel satisfied, but there's always, I hope, something waiting. And it reminds me of a well-known then author of popular books, Jerome Frank, who said to his son, I only feel as good as the book I'm working on.
Yeah.
Time, I think, for one more comment. Yes.
Sorry, it's just a very quick comment. Stephen this morning, he's gone. No, he's there, sorry. Stephen this morning used a word which I was very taken with. He talked about restitution, and we tend to think of reparation. Now, it seems to me, and I don't think I'm hair-splitting, that restitution has a different meaning to reparation. Mm-hmm. And I rather like the restitution rather than our usual word of reparation. But I think they're two different things.
Thank you.
Well, I think Stephen did talk about the background to the idea of restitution, which also had some resonances with Mari's talk. And in fact, Fairbairn does use the term restitution in his papers, and I've used the more common term of reparation, because although there may be deep differences of one sort or another, I think that reparation is probably more easily and commonly understood as the process of repair and bringing things back together in some way or another, whereas restitution may feel a little bit... I don't know,
legal
insurance.
Yes,
the world of insurance or something like that.
All right, I'd like to thank Graham very much and ask him to come up to the podium now to join the others for a panel discussion with all of you. Thank you, Graham.
Thank you.
Could I? Beautiful. Could I ask a question?
Yes, of course. Are you Mike?
Yes, I think I am.
All right, all set up.
Yeah, I think it's here.
Good.
It's sort of a question and sort of a comment, because I was struck by your discussion of art, and I heard half of Stephen's paper in the video room upstairs and Jonathan's comment. And then there was a person who in the audience made reference to Mary Milner. And the thing is that it seems to me that both the notion of restitution and the notion of reparation actually lurk around the compensatory activity of art and what it can give us. They both slip back in some kind of way into an extended notion. We know Freud didn't do much work on it, really, but an extended notion of sublimation. And I know it's a different, comes from a slightly different terminology, but there is, but it seems to me that Marion Milner doesn't actually fit in that approach to the question of the art object and the process of what it means to make art. Because if always, I mean, you said very importantly, it doesn't matter whether the artist is neurotic, psychotic, or healthy, what matters is the creative process involved in the construction of the art object.
Mm.
And it seems to me that we have to in some way separate out analytically, and art criticism analytically is very, very located in that idea of reparation in market, reparation, making up for, compensating for. And in the, when Jonathan responded to Stephen's presentation this morning, the clinical example he gave was indeed of a patient who hadn't had something, and the business of making art was a kind of restitution in a way, an enabling of something that hadn't been before. Now, I wonder what it would be like, and I don't know enough about Fairbairn, but I'm going to go away immediately and read your book and find out, about Fairbairn in relation to art. But for me, it seems to me we have to have a question mark over the idea of the art object as essentially making up for something rather than just making something.
You want to speak?
I know, but if the audience will forgive me, because it's really their turn. Okay. Well, it's just, I used to work out in Essex teaching at Brunel with a woman called Mirjana Renton, who's now dead, unfortunately, but very lively Yugoslav woman. And we used to have big theoretical discussions, and I'd nearly go off the road on the way back and forth from this thing, because she was so lively and fun. And one day we were talking about the theory of reparation, the Kleinian theory. We were both Kleinians. We were talking about creative work being built out of your guilt towards the object that you've damaged that you want to repair. And she said, and I was saying I thought there was something wrong with that and it was limiting and da-da-da-da, but I didn't know how to put it. And she said, I think architects build bigger than their guilt. I thought, right on, honey. And it's something to do. Well, then you start thinking, what about identification with the creativity of the mother or father? You know, there's mm-hmm. all that that's left out of that theory. Mm-hmm. And I think it leaves out the idea of people really doing something really new. Mm-hmm. But it never being good enough. That's what they keep telling us in those letters and biography. They're never satisfied. You weren't suggesting that maturity was satisfaction. Maturity is not about being self-satisfied, but more satisfaction than maybe torture. Just enough. Yeah.
I don't know that Fairbairn said this, but I know Sutherland, having read Fairbairn's self-analysis, said to himself that the reason he had not been capable of more abstract thinking until his 70s was that he had failed to confront his inability to allow his parents to gather in a creative union in his mind. Mm-hmm. He kept them very separate, and this inhibited his capacity for the artistic product of abstract thinking.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Eleanor.
I was very intrigued. Well, you know, I was intrigued by these three R's. You know, restitution, reparation, and the other one that just glanced in rectification. And I was thinking they're all in the same area. And what I was thinking, I'm very turned on by Bowlby talking about therapy as block mourning. And there may be a thing, if you have been traumatized, there's lots of things you can do, but you can't really, you know, I mean, you can come to terms with it and become less bitter. But there's no rectification. And I was wondering if there's something, you know, that we have to give up. What could somebody clarify rectification for me?
Well, I can introduce it.
Are you offering to clarify rectification?
I will, yes.
In my article in the book, I didn't discuss this in the presentation today, although Graham has also written about this. The review that Fairbairn wrote of Marion Milner's book is really one of the most beautiful pieces of writing that he did. And what I argue in my piece, my chapter in the book, is that finally, after the death of his mother and the death of his wife, he has access to joy in a way, and he gives it a new name. So I'll give you the fourth R. It's not a guilt-driven reparation, restitution, or rectification. All of those words suggest that there is an offense that must be atoned for. He provides instead the properly Hegelian term reconciliation. And the work of art then, he actually finally repudiates the Freudo-Kleinian sublimation model, which is based on this idea of some primal sin that must be repaired or atoned for. And he accedes to a joyous model. That's why fun is so important, in which he says making art is joyous. Making art is fun. And it is the reconciliation of the deepest antagonism, and it bridges the gap between the self and the other. Now, that may never have actually happened in his personal life fully, although I did hear from Cosmo Fairbairn about the fun of the vacations, and that's the way Eleanor Fairbairn spoke as well. So I want to hold on to that idea of reconciliation rather than restitution.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask for perhaps some thoughts on repetition. I don't know if anyone knows that wonderful old song, Does Your Chewing Gum Lose Its Flavor on the Bedpost Overnight? And I thought Leslie spoke very well about that idea of going back to a work of art endlessly and being able to repeat something of the satisfaction, and that would also be part of the creativity, the creative process. But it is repetition with a difference. It's not the repetition compulsion. It's repeating it, looking for something new,
And finding it. I think.
I think that the difference between reparation and restitution is, reparation implies always capacity of sublimation, and restitution doesn't.
Thank you.
I don't want another R word. I'm thinking about, Leslie, where you started us today, about transitional phenomenon and the fact that something new is created by the child, that it's neither mother nor the actual object, and that it really speaks to the potential of all of us for something emergent to come out of us. And we can't ever predict what the child's going to pick or how the child's going to use it. And I think that's true with art. It's true with psychotherapy and psychoanalysis. We can never predict how the patient's going to make use of us. And yet something emerges, an emergence, as another alternative to all the R's.
I think that it ties in with the discussions about symbolization in a way, because if one holds on to a notion of symbolization as essentially a capacity to replace one thing with another because you have to, then actually the fact of the making in itself isn't there. It's making in order, because the mother's not there, the child creates the transitional object. But in fact, the mother is both there and not there, and the child both creates and doesn't create the transitional object that's waiting. And there's something about that, I think, in terms of the production and the reception, because there's the creative receiver as well in the art object. And I think that's Marion Milner territory, actually.
Hello, I'm Ranaviram from New York. I was just actually going to give a another R. Wanted to say that when I finished writing my book, I was actually very... No, that was it. Actually, it was in grammar school, but I was going to say I was extremely satisfied with it, you know, and what wasn't satisfying is that no one bought it. And so, you know, the last R of recognition, in a sense, of kind of what you all are talking about, and I think Fairburn was talking about that very much.
I've been asked to have a repetition of something that Dr. Battley said. He introduced the term resignation.
I mean, there's two things that I think are probably somewhat at a tangent from what we've been discussing, but which come out of looking at Fairburn's own comments on in his paper reviewing Rickman's work, where he talks about these changes that you undergo in coming to terms with those things that you've been forced to or chosen to repress, hive off, put to one side, and that as those become available to you again, what you would then expect is a change in your social relationships. He doesn't ever talk about sublimation, however. Mm. He's talking about changes in internal relationships inevitably leading to changes in your external relationships with your social world and with the real material world around you. So as an artist, it'll be maybe a change of medium or direction or something like that. So that's one thing. And then a second thing is just to do with Marion Milner and the manic womb. Because she talks about the manic womb as the place in which all of this creativity is going to take place. And there is a way of drawing Fairburn's diagram, which if you include the preconscious, where you get a manic womb, which is a libidinal, anti-libidinal, and ideal, as this part in the preconscious, which is where I think a lot of creativity could come from, which would actually fit that description of the manic womb, as it were, because it's not conscious, it's preconscious, but it has all of those components in it.
Anne, you want to touch on?
Yes, I just think that dimension that Hannah Siegel and Winnicott use independently, but one could put them together, between a really concrete, maybe even just a sublimation, because sublimation doesn't always imply growth. It involves substitution, whereas the Kleinian concept of symbolization as opposed to symbolic equations implies growth and creativity. And what I just wanted to use that wonderful term, inexhaustibility. Anyway, I find it's so helpful if a child knows his therapist is pregnant, about to leave him, and he goes and hides in a cupboard. It can be that people assume it's concrete, defensive, symbolic equation. It might be happening in the transitional area and be semi-creative. Mm-hmm. He might be saying, gee, that would... But it could be, this is my place. At least I've got this. That's my term for the transitional. Yeah. At least I've got the cupboard. She's leaving me. Symbolic level, he can be saying, I know she's leaving me, but isn't this cupboard beautiful? And what I wanted to put the idea of real symbolism, Kleinian symbolism, together with this notion of inexhaustibility, because I just love that term. And that's the way the painters look at their own work, at each other's work. And if you read The Goldfinch, she comes back to that painting over and over again in the book, and she sees something more in it every single time, this very great painting. And that's what a real symbol permits you to do, I think. Yeah.
Well, I think this is what we find in the writing of Fairburn, as we can see from all the various contributions. There's always something else that someone else will see. I want to thank these three panelists for giving us a terrific afternoon on various aspects of how we might conceptualize psychic growth. And before we join our hands to thank them, I want to let you all know that we'll be meeting over on the Freud Museum, which is some doors up from here on this side of the street, to have a reception at which we will celebrate the book that was co-edited by Graham Clark and David Scharf, and at which Cosmo Fairburn will delight us, I know he'll delight me anyway, with a talk that will include his memories and his thoughts about Ronald Fairburn. invite you all now to thank the panelists, and we'll see you up the road.